He is a lifelong resident of Brooklyn, New York, and for a time, he was my colleague as a corporate lawyer at the law firm of Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison. In 2006, Hakeem Jeffries went into politics and was elected to the New York State Assembly. In 2012, Hakeem Jeffries was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives from Brooklyn. And in the 10 years since, he has had a meteoric rise within the House of Representatives, within Congress, and is today the House Minority Leader, leader of all Democrats in the House of Representatives, destined to one day be Speaker of the House. Hakeem Jeffries, welcome to WBGO. We know your time is precious. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary, and it is so wonderful to be with you and the WBGO family.
Thank you. So let me begin with this. I very much admire someone like yourself. You were born in Brooklyn. You still live in Brooklyn. Your family's in Brooklyn. I very much admire someone who has risen to greatness, fame, prominence, importance, but has stayed close to his roots. You have stayed close to your roots in Brooklyn. I read somewhere that you're a lifelong member of the same church. Why have you stayed in Brooklyn all these years?
Well, you know, Brooklyn is a special place, and it's been an honor and a blessing to have been raised in this community, born in Brooklyn Hospital. As you mentioned, grew up in the Cornerstone Baptist Church in Bedford-Stuyvesant, where I still attend, and now have the great honor to represent the communities from whence I came. In so many ways, that's part of what the system of government that has been devised, going all the way back to that constitutional convention in Philadelphia, and an outgrowth of that in the House of Representatives in particular, was an institution designed to be the closest to the American people, the House, and to reflect, you know, the hopes, the dreams, the aspirations, the fears, the concerns, the anxieties, the passions of the American people. And I now have that great opportunity and have had for the last decade to serve the people of Central Brooklyn and beyond in the House and to try to build upon my life experiences, my journey, to provide, you know, the highest level of representation to meet the needs of the people I serve and to work with other members of Congress to try to deliver for the people of America.
How would you describe the demographic of your district?
So it's an incredibly diverse district. It historically has been the ninth most African-American district in the country and the 16th most Jewish. So I'm often told, one of my good friends, Leon Goldenberg, says, Hakeem, you got the best of both worlds, which is true, an incredible African-American community, an incredible Jewish community. And beyond that, African-Americans, Caribbean-Americans, Latinos, South Asians, Irish-Americans, Italian-Americans, and every different type of ethnic group that you would expect to find in Brooklyn, a place where people have historically come from all over the world to pursue the American dream. So it's a gorgeous mosaic of individuals, diversity of every kind, racial, religious, ethnic, artistic, cultural, and socioeconomic.
We've gone through every 10 years a whole series of redistricting. Is your district historically the Shirley Chisholm district, or is that a different district?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the Bedford-Stuyvesant and East New York portions of the district that I represent were once represented by the great Shirley Chisholm. Bedford-Stuyvesant, in fact, was the core of the congressional district that Shirley Chisholm was first elected to as the first Black woman ever to serve in Congress back in 1968. So it's a great honor and a privilege to stand on her incredibly broad shoulders. Now, Shirley Chisholm, as you know, served in Congress for 14 years from 1968 to 1982. When Shirley Chisholm retired from Congress, and at the time there was only one predominantly African-American, Caribbean-American district in Central Brooklyn, but because of the growth of the population, when she retired from Congress in 1982, and there was a new redistricting, there were two predominantly African-American districts that emerged one district represented by Congressman Ed Towns and the other district represented by Congressman Major Owens, also, I believe, a prominent Morehouse graduate, as you, Mr. Secretary, Morehouse graduate. But once that happened, there was a longstanding friendly dispute as to what congressional district was actually the rightful heir to the legacy of Shirley Chisholm. Eventually, Ed Towns retired, Major Owens retired, Yvette Clark was elected, and then I was elected to serve in those congressional districts. And I'm happy to report that we have finally resolved the controversy as to who represents the district that is rightfully the heir to Shirley Chisholm's legacy. We've concluded that we both are, because Shirley Chisholm was such a bad sister that it takes at least two members of Congress to replace her. So we all claim the legacy of Shirley Chisholm in Central Brooklyn.
I'd love that story. So speaking of former members of Congress going back to the 1970s who are Black, in January, I interviewed Andrew Young, MLK Weekend. Andrew Young is now 91 years old. We talked about the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. on MLK Weekend. And I want to play a short excerpt for you. Ambassador, on MLK Day, what would you have Americans do and think about this day, about Martin Luther King's legacy? What is it you want them to know? And what is it you want us to do?
I want them to realize that his movement was a success. I mean, after all, you were in charge of Homeland Security. Barack Obama was president of the United States. I mean, I never thought I would see, I mean, Hakeem Jeffries, the brother, was reminding me of Martin Luther King.
So that's quite a tribute coming from someone who was one of Martin Luther King's closest friends, still living. Hakeem, how do you react when you hear that?
Well, it was an incredibly generous observation. I do believe, as Ambassador Young indicated, that we all stand on the broad shoulders of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Ambassador Young, Fannie Lou Hamer, John Lewis, and so many of the incredible civil rights heroes who fought for a better America to create opportunities for those of us to stand on their broad shoulders. I had the chance to spend a little time with Ambassador Young a few months ago down in Atlanta, get the benefit of his wisdom and insight and encouragement. And as someone who was one of the founders of the Congressional Black Caucus, you know, just made clear to him that anything that we've accomplished as the CBC has grown from its original 13 or so members to now approaching 60 in the United States Congress over a 50-year period of time, that that's a direct result of the battles and the struggles and the eloquence and the strength and the heart and soul and the intellect with which they fought to create opportunities for all of us. And so I continue to draw inspiration from Ambassador Young. And he had mentioned to me that some of the observations that he's heard some of us within the Congressional Black Caucus make on the floor of the House has reminded him of some of the linguistical tools that were on full display by Dr. King and others. And I said, that is for good reason, because we draw strength and inspiration from the eloquence and the power of the words that Dr. King and Andrew Young and others used throughout the years and are still relevant and important to this very day.
Congressman Jeffries, you are today House Minority Leader. You are leader of the Democrats in the House of Representatives. As the leader of a caucus, is it your role to find consensus or build consensus? How would you describe it?
It's a great question. And I think it's a bit of both, that House Democrats, we're proud of the fact that we believe we closely approximate, better than any other caucus in the Congress, the American people, because we most closely resemble in the fullest possible way the diversity of the American people. racially, ethnically, religiously, in terms of gender, sexual orientation, life experience, ideology, region. And that also means that there may be a diversity of perspective and opinion on a given issue. And we embrace the fact that we should be able to have sometimes exuberant and noisy conversations about the right set of policies to put people over politics, to make a difference for everyday Americans, and to really bring the American dream to life, which is what we are there to do. We can have noisy conversations, exuberant conversations about that. But at the end of the day, I think all of us within House Democratic leadership, building upon the great work of what Speaker Pelosi and Majority Leader Hoyer and Majority Whip Jim Clyburn did for so many years, is to always, at the end of the day, find the highest common denominator so we can come together, make progress, advance the ball legislatively, and then live to fight another day.
So many of us in private life look at the House, we look at the Congress in Washington, and we see acrimony, disagreement, sharp disagreement. One of the things I know from my own public service is that you all behind the scenes tend to get along a lot better than we realize. But still, it's an acrimonious, difficult place. How do you cut through the acrimony and get stuff done?
That's actually a question that I should be asking you, Mr. Secretary, because in the times that we overlapped, you were one of the better-liked secretaries within the administration across both sides of the aisle, and you managed to always find that opportunity, even when we agree to disagree without being disagreeable with each other. And I think, you know, that's sort of the approach that we've all tried to take. You're correct that Congress is both divided, because the American people are divided sharply on a whole host of issues. We certainly don't share the same perspective on the Democratic side and on the Republican side on issues related to the climate crisis or gun violence or reproductive freedom, Social Security, Medicare, in some cases, even democracy itself. But at the same period of time, I'm very proud of the fact that under the leadership of President Biden, if you look at the last Congress, many of the important things that we were able to do and get over the legislative finish line were bipartisan in nature. From the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, where we're going to create millions of good paying jobs, fix our crumbling bridges, roads, tunnels, airports, and sewer and water systems, clean water in every single community, bipartisan, largely or more so in the Senate, but it was bipartisan in getting it over the finish line. Same thing with the gun safety legislation that we were able to pass for the first time in 30 years that is going to save lives. More certainly needs to be done. But the only reason why we were able to enact the Safer Communities Act is because we were able to secure bipartisan support in the House and in the Senate. The CHIPS and Science Act, another incredibly important legislative accomplishment, where we're bringing domestic manufacturing jobs back home to the United States of America, again, through the leadership of President Biden. We were able to get that bill done in a bipartisan way. And those were just three examples, amongst others, of some of the more important legislative accomplishments over the last several years that actually have secured support from both Democrats and Republicans. And that news doesn't often get reported out of Washington, D.C., because there's often a greater emphasis on reporting out conflict and controversy as opposed to consensus and common ground. But the consensus and the common ground does occur. And we're going to continue, as I said during the beginning of this Congress, to try to find that common ground with the other side of the aisle whenever and wherever possible. But at the same time, make it clear that we're going to push back against extremism whenever necessary.
Are you optimistic about the future?
I am optimistic about the future because we have no other option. Failure is not an option. And when you think about sort of this great American project, which is now 247 years old, we'll be celebrating our 250th anniversary on July 4th of 2026. Throughout that journey, there have been trials and tribulations. There's been trauma. There's been turbulence, whether that's the Civil War or the Great Depression after the stock market unexpectedly collapsed in October of 1929. A foreign power unexpectedly struck on December 7th of 1941. All of a sudden, we were plunged into a great conflict with the evil empire of Nazi Germany. The Greatest Generation emerged to get us through that great conflict and in many ways save not just American society, but democracy and the world. If you look at the trauma of the Deep South in the Jim Crow years, where we were struggling to reconcile the inherent contradictions of Jim Crow segregation, racial oppression, as compared to the beautiful promises of equality and liberty that were in the Constitution. We made it through that moment when the towers were struck on September 11th, unexpectedly, that plunged us into a conflict in terms of dealing with global terrorism that now had reached our shores. Even on January 6th, when violent insurrectionists temporarily ran us off the floor of the House and the Senate as part of an effort to stop the peaceful transfer of power for the first time in American history. Every time we've confronted real trauma and adversity in our past, we've always figured out a way as Americans, not as Democrats or Republicans, but as Americans, to make it to the other side. And so building upon that great history, I think that the American people will once again summon the resiliency and the spirit, the heart and soul, the drive necessary to get us through this very turbulent moment and to continue to build and make America the best version of herself.
Congressman Jeffries, I'm mindful of your time. I simply want to conclude this interview by saying thank you for all you do for our country, for our community, for Brooklyn itself. I recall a conversation you and I had about 7 or 8 years ago when you were being encouraged to run for mayor of New York. And I remember what I said to you then. You have to stay in Washington and build on what you are doing there. And I'm so glad that you are now House Minority Leader. And I know that one day I'll be referring to you as Speaker Jeffries. So, Hakeem, thank you for everything you do for our country and keep up the fine work. And thank you for joining me on WBGO.
Well, Jay, I appreciate you. It's an honor to be on the show. And thank you for being there. For me, from the very beginning of my journey as a young lawyer through the assembly into Congress and to this very moment.